Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 60 of Registry Matters. Well, Larry, here we are at the end of January, or not the end, the middle end, the second half of January, however you want to put it. And it's a Saturday night, it's 7:18 p.m. Eastern time. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fantastic. We would be recording at the proper time, except for technical glitches, which we hope do not recur.
If they do, I'm throwing all of your equipment off of that gorge bridge.
You do that. You come out here and you go to the gorge bridge.
I'm going to do it because, for you to sound like Darth Vader and me to sound like Darth Vader, it was not fun. There was a question.
I am hearing a popping in the background, but hopefully that won't be, people won't hear that when we do the playback, but I can hear a little bit of popping.
It could be me playing with a piece of chapstick.
It only happens when you're speaking.
I fidget with my hands. I usually have like something that I try to play with. Like I click a pen, but I do it underneath the desk and I try to keep it as quiet as possible.
This is an electronic pop. Trust me.
I've got
hundreds of thousands of phone calls in my repertoire and I can distinguish that sound.
Do tell, Larry, how do you have hundreds of thousands of phone calls in your repertoire?
I've been in the marketing business for a very long time.
Marketing? Oh, that's fascinating. I didn't realize that you'd been in marketing.
Yes, I have.
Do you want to elaborate on that ever so slightly?
No, I think most people hate telemarketers enough. I think we should move on.
I have a question regarding, I guess we have an article coming up. So we'll just dive right in. I was going to ask a question about the funding of the courts and so forth and how that's going to be impacted. But we have some articles from the New York Times that will cover that at the end. So we'll just dive right on in. And so with that, without further ado, we're going to welcome a new patron, David. I think I may have missed him. He's been on the roster for a couple weeks now, but so very much thank you. And you're coming in at the hustler level with a little extra tossed in. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's really appreciated. And it's very humbling, as we continually say, that for people to support the podcast. It's just really appreciated. It's awesome.
I can't imagine why they would pay to listen to me and you, especially you.
Here's the thing. Everyone that signs up, I actually pay them just to pad your ego a little bit. So it looks like we're actually getting some funding, but I'm actually supporting the whole thing.
Well, that's especially humbling then.
All right. So first up, we have a voicemail from Will, and so we'll jump right into that.
This is Will from Tennessee again, and I recently listened to RM 59, three Supreme Court denials. And Larry, when discussing why the court is so hesitant to rule against anything registry-related, he mentioned that Justice Roberts had been, I think, the Alaska attorney or a state attorney. And we all know that in lower courts, when a judge has personal knowledge of a case, he has to recuse himself because it's a conflict of interest. At what point does it become a conflict of interest for a Supreme Court justice when they have to hear cases that involves laws that they either helped, that they were either the architect for, helped in the wording, or were a state's attorney that fought to uphold the law? At what point do histories with legislation become conflicts of interest for a Supreme Court justice?
But I think he has some details wrong, though, doesn't he?
Well, he's on the right path conflict of interest. And I think we could probably have an expert come on that could do this far more justice than what I'll be able to do. But I can tell you that merely having knowledge of a case is not enough for recusal. If that was the case, there'd be practically every judge would be recusing from everything, because I can't think of a lot of issues that judges don't have knowledge. It becomes a little bit more cloudy and murky when they have a personal relationship with one of the parties, other than a professional relationship. He's on the right path of justice. Elena Kagan worked for the Department of Justice before she was named to the court, and she recused herself from anything that the Department of Justice was involved in, which caused her to sit out several decisions after she was on the court. There's example after example. Judges get named to the bench. There are prosecutors in my state. That happens quite commonly. I'm sure it does in others. They become judges, and they've been attorneys in some capacity, either a prosecutor or defense attorney. If they've been a prosecutor, oftentimes they will recuse themselves from hearing anything that their former office was involved in. For example, if a judge here gets on the bench and he or she was formerly with the district attorney's office prosecuting, well, that's going to create a problem if they get on the criminal bench rather than the civil bench, because practically everything coming to the criminal court is going to be prosecuted by the district attorney's office. So they've generally taken a more narrow view, that they recuse themselves when it's stuff that their particular unit was involved in. If they were the crimes against children's unit, then they would recuse themselves from that. So Will's on the right path, that there is a, I think the model rules of professional conduct go so far as to suggest recusal when there's an appearance of a conflict. But we have to keep in mind, for the Supreme Court to decide to review a case, it only takes 4 justices to grant cert of 9. And they can vote to grant cert for different reasons. They could be wanting to overturn the law, or they'd be wanting to affirm the law. So the fact that Justice Roberts was directly involved in Smith versus Doe, I don't think that we could say that that's the reason in of itself that it can't muster the 4 votes for the other cases that are coming. The point I was making is that a lot of our conservative colleagues out there, are supporters, and I shouldn't call them colleagues, but a lot of our conservative supporters believe that the Supreme Court's just chomping at the bit to re-examine registration. I merely opine that based on the fact that they're turning most everything down for cert, that does not appear to be borne out by the evidence. And that since Justice Roberts was Alaska's attorney at the time, that for him to want to undo his previous work, he's going to have to really recognize that he got it wrong. Or he could sidestep that and say, I was right at the time, but the law, as it has evolved, it's no longer the law that I fought for when I represented the state of Alaska. So at this point, I can come to a different conclusion. I mean, he could do that, but I just don't think that he goes to bed at night thinking, well, how can we get the registry? How can we tame this registry? I just don't think a lot of the justices are thinking in those terms. That was my point.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I've heard that a bunch, that I'm trying to remember where I heard it even this week, that someone had said that the Supreme Court is just waiting for the opportunity to shut this thing down. And I don't feel that it is that way, because you would see changes being done at different levels before it gets up there to the top dogs. I mean, you would see things happening at the state level. Even, you know, we constantly cover articles where they're increasing the strictness of living restrictions and so forth. So I don't feel that it's going in that direction at all.
Well, I think that being true, but there's even more telling. When the state of Michigan asked the Supreme Court to review Doe versus Snyder, if they were chomping at the bit to make a national proclamation about registration, they could have taken that case, and what would have been binding in the Sixth Circuit only would have become binding in the whole entire country if they were chomping at the bit. When the Pennsylvania case of Munez, when district attorney was in whatever county it was in Pennsylvania, filed a petition for cert, if they had been chomping at the bit, they could have taken that case. They didn't.
Right.
They will get other opportunities. There's a case, the 10th Circuit the 10th Circuit has yet to rule yet. But if they affirm Judge, that's the Millard versus Rankin case, if they affirm Judge Mage, I would very much anticipate Colorado would appeal. That's what the attorney that was on the case said she expected. They can chomp at the bit and take that case. So I mean, I just don't see them chomping at the bit. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I just don't see that chomping occurring.
Let me just play partial devil's advocate. Do you think that they are looking at the cases that are being presented and they go, it's not strong enough, we want to wait till something more concrete hits the desk to see if they're going to rule on it, instead of trying to do something that might be half-ass?
Well, they could, but Michigan had a pretty strong case. Not Michigan, but the people on our side in Michigan, they had a very onerous registry in Michigan in terms of all the restrictions that had been heaped on through the years. The only thing that I don't think Michigan was doing was charging fees, but they had the prohibitions on people where they could live and all these proximity restrictions, and they had juiced up the requirements of frequency of reporting and the length of registration. And so it was pretty onerous. I mean, I suppose they could wait for the Alabama case that's been bobbing around in the 11th Circuit for so long. I'm wondering if the 11th Circuit is ever going to rule, but that's the McGuire case. But other than that, I can't think of anything that would be much more onerous than what they could have reviewed in the Michigan case.
Is there anything that like lets them time out? Or, I mean, what is the process if they have to make a positive affirmation or denial of hearing a thing or deciding on a thing?
Well, they do. They deny the petition for cert. You get a one-line order saying your petition for cert has been denied.
Okay, and everything will have a positive or negative confirmation, correct?
You'll either get granted cert or you'll be denied.
Okay. There's no limbo is what I mean, you just described that one in Alabama being
in
limbo.
That's at the 11th Circuit. It's not at the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know of anything timing out at the Circuit Court, but the Supreme Court disposes of its cases one way or the other.
That's right. But the circuit courts don't necessarily do that?
I'm not aware of anything that requires them to render a decision.
Interesting. Maybe you'll just go away. We'll ignore you long enough.
Well, that's true. If they wait long enough, McGuire might die. If I were Alabama, I would say that's no longer a justiciable controversy, that the guy that would be granted relief is dead.
Huh.
The case
this
is now
system
moot.
Of ours, man. Yeah.
It's okay. Now moot. Not mute, but moot.
Yes. Yes. Which is the same as when you see in all the mob movies where they try and go kill the some witness somewhere. And if the witness is gone, then the case falls, right?
It's sometimes the witness can be very critical to the case.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in this case, I mean, if you're the one with the standing and you're no longer standing, then I guess it all goes away.
Well, the issue, they would argue, if I were on the other side, I would argue that there are exceptions to the mootness doctrine, and that's with an issue that's capable of repetition, and that repetition would be best resolved by getting a decision here, because this matter is going to keep coming up again and again. I would argue that. I'm not saying that they would buy it, but there are exceptions to the mootness doctrine. But as a general rule, when the parties are no longer willing or able to participate, that case becomes moot. I mean, if the defendant dies, what's the point in prosecuting them? If you're in a criminal prosecution, what are you going to do once you get a conviction?
Sure.
So you have to tell the family, "Well, I'm sorry, we don't need you anymore. The person's dead."
Sure. All right, then. Well, patron Jeff, he's one of our newest patrons, and he says, just finished listening to episode number 59. I got it a day early because I'm a patron now. Woohoo! I really enjoyed the episode like normal, but I did have a question. You guys were talking about how circuits sometimes become split and that forces the Supreme Court to get involved. At least that's what I understood. I don't always understand what you guys are talking about. I'll be honest here, there's lots of legal jargon I don't understand. But one of the circuits that you guys mentioned was split is the Sixth Circuit, which is the circuit that I live in. Could you elaborate in a future episode what it means if circuits are split and what it specifically means regarding the Sixth Circuit being split? I know Larry is very, very smart, but if he can try to dumb it down for someone like me so I can understand, take care. Thank you, Jeff. Larry?
That's a really good question, Jeff. The Sixth Circuit is, when I say split, it's not split amongst itself. It has split from its sister circuits in finding that registration can evolve to the point that it becomes punitive and it's no longer a civil regulatory scheme. To my knowledge, other than Judge Mache, who's not a circuit, he's a district judge, to my knowledge, no other circuit has concluded that at the federal level. So we already have a split because of the 11 circuit courts of appeal. We have one circuit court, the Sixth, saying that it is punitive, and we've got 10 others plus the D.C. Circuit saying that it is not punitive. So we already have a circuit split. A split among the circuits does not guarantee that the Supreme Court is going to jump in, because if it did, they would have granted the state of Michigan's cert petition to hear that case. It does, according to what the Supreme Court tells us. They tell us a little bit about how they select their cases. They don't tell us everything because, honestly, I believe they take things that entertain them. I mean, they're at the pinnacle of their career, and they want to decide important issues. They're not, and they have said that justice is not one of the considerations. That an injustice, someone that's suffering from an injustice, is not enough to get them involved. So if you think just because you've got an injustice that the Supreme Court's going to hear it, they have proclaimed a long time ago that that's not what they want to decide important matters to help the lower courts understand how to decide cases. They could have jumped in on the split. They didn't. They may be waiting for more circuits to split. If you take the best, if you look at the most positive light, well, they're wanting to see how this case law develops below. And when they get ready to opine about where registration becomes punitive, they may be wanting more case law below, more building of the factual basis of below of how the different circuits have decided the cases. That's my best spin I can put on it. But the circuit split means simply that among the 11 circuits that there are different opinions on essentially the same question presented, and courts can come with different opinions. Law is not black and white. I mean, we have the Andy doctrine where we should feed everything into a computer and we'd get an answer, but you can look at the same statute and you can come up with a different interpretation of what it means. And I always refer to late Justice Scalia as example. This is his, not mine. He said on, I believe it was Meet the Press, that he appeared on some number of years ago. He said, take a statute that says that the prevailing party shall recover attorney's fees. He says, what does that mean? He says, well, I'm a textualist. I believe it means exactly what it says. The attorneys will be paid. But he said those people that subscribe to purposivism, and that was the word he used, not me. He said the people who believe in purposivism, they would look at the intent of the law, which is to make the prevailing party whole, which you would not only have attorney's fees, but you would have cost related to getting to the finish line, which could be horrendous in this modern age we live in, where we have experts for everything, and you have a tremendous amount of out-of-pocket expenses. Justice Scalia said, the lawmakers who put these statutory schemes together, they're smart. They know how to provide in their text. If they want you to recover those out-of-pocket costs, they can say that. And for him to decide that that's what they meant, that would be overstepping his authority. So we can have exactly the same words on a page and have different interpretations, and there's nothing sinister about them. Are you a textualist or are you a purposivist?
That's a funny word.
Purposivist. And most of our people would think of themselves as textualist until you don't like the – see, what I struggle with on this podcast is I try to get people to think through because they truly believe that they're a textualist. And then when I say, well, okay, you got in Nebraska that case where the federal court came up with the purpose of the Nebraska law, which was to shield juveniles, the state Supreme Court said, nope, they didn't say that. They said anyone who relocates to Nebraska who is required to register in another state, you are a person, right?
Yes,
you are
required
to register in Colorado, right? You right. did move to Nebraska, right? Well, then right. that fits within the text. Don't ask us to carve out an exemption for you because the legislators didn't do it. Well, I believe that all of my good friends out there who subscribe to textualism and who they don't want all that legislating from the bench and all that liberal do-good interpretation, they should be applauding that ruling. That's exactly what a textualist would say.
Right.
They would, gee, well, I didn't really mean it quite like that. I'm a textualist except for...
Right, except for when it doesn't fit what I'm interpreting as.
What I would like to have interpreted as. That's what they mean. And what happens is these things are difficult to get through the legislative process, and you sometimes need activist courts to do things that the legislative process could never be persuaded to do because of public opinion, but it's the right thing to do, which that kind of goes against people who say, well, I don't want no legislating from the bench. Well, sometimes that's how we get to where we're going by the finish line is we have a little bit of legislating from the bench. But in this case, that we're talking about, I think with this, with the registry, I don't think we're going to get a lot of legislating from the bench. I think we're going to have to prove that it's punitive, and we're going to have to prove it with the clearest of, using the standard the Supreme Court set down in Broderick versus Oklahoma decades ago. The burden is on us to show by the clearest of proof that the legislative enactment is deficient of the Constitution, and it's on us to show that. I don't think they're going to do a lot of legislating from the bench. I really don't.
Well, all right then. Are you ready to move on to...
There goes our ratings down.
I know. Every week, we seem to be trying to drive our numbers down to zero. And honestly, it's not really working. They are going the other direction. So maybe we should try harder?
But here's what they will tell me after that comment. They'll say, Larry, with your defeatist attitude, no wonder we can't make any progress. You know, if you just go into things with such a negative outlook... No wonder where we are. That's the comment that's made. Is if you just wouldn't have a defeatist attitude. Well, I'm trying to call it the way it appears to me with the information I have. I don't have any information that suggests that the court is chomping at the bit. If any of you guys got that information, please share it with us on the podcast. But I don't see it.
I'm with you. Well, all right. So this one comes from PIX11.com. Ban on gay conversion therapy poised for passage in New York. I have a question for you, Larry. Do you think that you can convert a straight person to be gay?
I've not heard any evidence of that. There's actually that fear, though, and that's part of what's caused some of the phobia about gays. The real fundamentalist Christians will tell you that. Well, they can't produce and reproduce on their own. So the only way they can get more of them is that they have to convert our young. So we have to be protecting and taking care of our young and make sure they don't convert them. So even though I don't believe you can convert people, I believe that there's the fear of that out there.
But if you can't convert straight to gay, then why would you be able to convert gay to straight?
Well, but I say there are people who believe that conversion. I mean, there is a grain of logic in it. If you can't reproduce, then if you assume that they do, that it's a chosen life, which is a part of their philosophical outlook. They believe that God made man and woman, Adam and Eve, and God made them naturally them to be attracted to one another's opposites. And they believe that. I'm not condemning their beliefs. And they believe that with all their heart. And they believe that for someone to not have that attraction, they believe that there must be something causing that that's either wrong with them or they've been converted. And so therefore, there's a fear that there's people being converted. I don't buy into that fear. I don't believe that anyone, I'm never aware of anyone who's been converted to gay. I've aware of people who've come out and who've suppressed their sexuality for a long time and they felt comfortable in coming out. But I'm not aware of anyone who has come out who says, well, actually, I changed my mind. I've tried it both ways and I like this better.
Maybe. I recently heard an interview, a fairly long, extensive interview with one of the people that was like massively driving that bus of gay conversion therapy and indoctrinating all kinds of people into this lifestyle that you could convert people, running classes, and so many of those people end up committing suicide. It is a really tragic thing that they just run around and they shame you. And I just feel, I'm sure that there are gay people that do it for other reasons than they are quote unquote wired that way. But if you're just wired that way, then there's not something necessarily wrong. And I can't imagine why society would want you to live alone, why they would want you to be shunned. It is really highly detrimental to the psychology of someone. And I'm not gay. I'm perfectly happy like with the female form. I think that's an amazing thing. But why do I care what you do with your junk that I need to worry about converting you to where you put your junk?
Well, I don't know why you can't understand that, Andy.
I find it really offensive because there's literally no science behind it. I'm seriously about some science stuff. And if anybody can find me any evidence that says this stuff works and it has to be like peer reviewed and actual like credible and not from some very, very biased source, I would be interested to hear it. But I have heard of nothing even remotely close. I'll put it in the same category as polygraphs, that this is just some really bunk just some wizardry going on that people are trying to convert people in, on their orientation.
Well, I don't have a lot of faith in junk science either. But if a person is really struggling with this issue and they want to have therapy, I don't think that it would be the government's place to say you can't do that. But I'm not clear what type of conversion therapy, if it's being forced upon these adolescents, or if it's of their own choosing. If you're a teenager, well, you don't have a teenager yet, or do you? But if he comes to you and says, "I'm struggling with this and I want some therapy," because I just don't want to be that kind of yucky person. Would that be something that you would be opposed to?
That becomes an issue of. Well, that's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought about it that way. He just turned 12, so no, he's not a teenager. But if he decided, if he felt that it is wrong to be one way or the other, I don't know that I would try and get him treatment to flip his thinking. I would try to get him treatment to understand the way that he's thinking isn't necessarily wrong.
Person is struggling and saying, I just can't be that. I'm feeling those urges, but that's not who I want to be. And I've heard of that happening. Then I think maybe some therapy would be in order. And then the question is how far you go with that therapy. If the person says, this is exactly what I feel inside, and that's who I want to be, and that's the way I think God made me, who are you to decide how God made someone?
Absolutely. But I mean, if you are just totally like wired to be, here it comes, I'm going to say it. You ready? Here comes the bombshell. If you are totally wired to like goober gobbling, then it isn't necessarily wrong that you would feel that way, and you shouldn't necessarily be converted out of it. If that's how you feel, if that's the way that you are wired to like to be attracted to someone, then, and it doesn't have to be about that either. It could just be, hey, you just find that sex to be the attractive one. Why? How could someone else say that based on a book, based on their worldview, that your worldview is wrong?
Well, I'm agreeing with you on that. But I'm saying those people who hold those deep religious beliefs, they truly, I mean, they say, well, we love the homosexuals. We love them dearly. We want to help them. Okay, well, how do you help them? Well, we want to get them therapy so that they can get over this illness. They view it as an illness. And if it's not an illness, they view it as a sinister choice of engaging in an abomination. They call that an abomination, I believe.
I agree with you.
And we love you, but we want you to quit engaging in this abominable behavior.
But the DSM doesn't view it that way. So why would we not accept what the accepted science is over the other view?
Well, like I said, I'm not going to trash anyone's religious beliefs, but that's they good people believe dearly in their religiosity, if there's such a word, and they believe that that book, as it's been interpreted to them, is the way it should be, and they believe that this is an abomination and a chosen life.
All right, then. I'm going to have to ponder on that one a little bit longer.
I'm glad we could give you something to ponder about.
Well, here's an interesting one. The FCC revokes a ham license for convicted sex offender. This actually is a pretty old article. I didn't even realize that this is an article that's about almost 5 years old, 4.5 years old. But it's out of RadioWorld.com. But I think the issue still is relevant in that, first of all, how many people, if you are under the age of 30, do you even know what a ham radio is? Do you know that there are like people that do hobby radio stuff where they communicate and they bounce radio signals off the clouds and talk to people in Australia halfway around the world?
I'm over 30 twice over, and I barely know what it is, so I would not be surprised.
But so, I mean, if like a ridiculously small number of people would be impacted by this, but so here's a guy that the way the article reads, I believe the person is currently, he would probably be in his 30s now, but he was convicted of, at 18, of some indecent liberties with a child, whatever. And so he's a convicted sex felon, and did 25 months in prison, and then some judge on the panel for the FCC says that he can't hold a ham radio license because he would do evil things over the radio with children?
Oh, it's possible. Right. I mean, when you were growing up, didn't you get on the ham radio and try to be solicited by adults? I mean, I know I did.
I got half of that one. I did try to get on the ham radio. I did not try to get solicited by adults.
Well, but wouldn't you imagine they're lurking out there? Is that, I mean, before the internet was the prevalent way that they lurk, wouldn't they have been lurking on other means to? No, you know I'm being devil's advocate here, but wouldn't they have been lurking somehow?
Yeah, but I'm thinking about the distances here. It, generally speaking, AM radio is not good at short distances. FM radio would be good in your neighborhood, you know, or maybe up to your county level. It's going to be good for 10 or 20 miles. AM radio is not going to be good at 10 or 20 miles. It's going to be good at like 200 miles. So now you're going to be picking up the kids at, you know, the next state over, which I know people do, but I don't think like the statistics there seem to be a really big long shot.
Well, they're just going by the black letter law. It says in the book that you can't have this type of conviction to hold a license, and that's the way it is. If you want to change the law, change the law.
Yeah, I guess that's what, and pretty much everything that we ever cover is like, if you don't like it, go change it. Well, how do you change it? Oh, we have to change the legislators. How do we get the public to go for that? It, yeah, it's this big long process. But this one just like sticks out as bothering me. Perhaps like some overreach, maybe.
Yeah, well,
Do you
like
see it that
say,
way at all?
I do. I mean, it's one of those things where we probably would have a hard time explaining why we're doing it. That as time evolves, we don't understand. If you ask a person, well, we've always done it that way. And I tell people that's the only reason you can come up with. It's probably time for you to re-examine why you're doing it that way. I mean, I don't even know. Does anybody talk on ham radios anymore?
They still do, for sure. That has been like one of the backup plans, and like the what's the word I'm looking for? The ham radio operators, they stay in existence, and they're waiting for that whole doomsday thing to drop, and where they can be the final leg of communication after World War III or whatever. I don't know. Yeah, but there are still ham radio operators out there.
I hear so little about. I mean, when's the last time you've heard of anybody on a CB radio?
Yeah, I wonder that as I've been traveling around lately, and I'm fairly certain that the truckers are still using it.
Really?
But
All the hundreds of truckers we've got listening out there, tell us if you're still using CBs, because I'd be surprised.
yeah, no doubt. Here's an article that's totally right up your alley, and it's from Above the Law. Above the Law. How to pick a good criminal defense attorney. And it goes through and lists five different questions that you might want to ask your to keep in mind as you are looking into a criminal defense attorney. And my favorite one so far in reading this is the fifth one, where it says, beware of websites like Avvo that claim to rate lawyers. I don't know what else you could use, honestly, to rate a lawyer, but that website pops up pretty prominently as saying, this is a good one, this is a bad one. But they do say in there that maybe there might be some kickback programs involved between the lawyers and like different like top 50 lawyers thing. And we got called out. I don't want to say called out. Leah Bickerton has one of these awards, and she was like, what? Oh yeah, I think somebody sent me a letter and I paid a fee. So yeah, it's like totally, you know, not really, it's not like rated by your peers or anything like that.
Well, for those who choose to read the article, I liked point number one: don't automatically disqualify the public defender. And explains that generally public defenders are among the best trained, the most savvy attorneys you can get. They know the lay of the land and have probably tried more cases than private attorneys, and generally are driven by mission, not money, because I can assure you they very seldom get anywhere near the compensation they can get in the private system. So that I agree with that point. I agree with point two about word of mouth, but be careful on word of mouth, because someone may have been a good attorney for one particular need, and they're not suited for your needs. I'm not sold on point number three on the internet. I know that's the way everything's done these days, but I'm not sold that the internet's going to be all that useful to you. Number four, the amount of money the person charged doesn't always correlate with excellence. I agree with that.
Certainly.
The people, the one senior lawyer advised a younger lawyer, find out what a person does for a living, figure out the highest amount he can pay, and that's what you charge. Well, that's some
I've
truth
heard
in
about
that.
using that for computer consulting.
Yes, there's some truth in that. So just because a person tells you they'll charge you $50,000 doesn't mean you're going to get $50,000 worth of representation. And So, and then number five, which you've already covered, about the AVO. Mm-hmm. And what are some other ones other than AVO that do the same thing?
I'm not sure of any others offhand. I encountered AVO in looking up some attorneys. I'm, you know, obviously doing a Google search, but that just gets you the yellow book, yellow pages listing of them. But another part mission of this podcast is to put, you know, spoon feed some information into our listeners' brains about maybe some of the questions that you would be asking of an attorney, because most of us are looking for some kind of relief, which is going to require some level of litigation, which is going to require an attorney, which means you have to start asking them certain kinds of questions and understanding their answers. Like one question would be, have you ever represented anybody post-conviction before? Yes or no? I mean, that would be one question to find out if they only do pre-trial work or post stuff, right?
Right. And the summation here is, so how do you really know the lawyer's right for you? Common sense. Do they return calls promptly? Do they listen to your questions and answer them intelligently? And where the news is good or bad, do they appear knowledgeable and have a what does that say? That's cutting off that word there. Something presence, seem at home in court and have a reputation for fighting like hell. Have a web presence. Okay. The attorney that you talk to may be a very good attorney and they may do all the things well, but they're not suited for your needs. And that's where we're going to have to get better in helping people figure out. Most of our people are post-conviction, and that's a different type of an attorney. And most of the time, the post-conviction attorneys, the doors have already been closed by rules where you can't undo your plea. So you're like trying to thread a needle through a haystack in terms of post-conviction. You have very limited options when you've done a plea because you've jettisoned so many of your rights in that plea process. But knowing when you've got a good lawyer, it's tough. It really is. Figuring out the right questions to ask. I happen to have done it a few times on helping people. And, you know, we talk about our friend in Georgia, which I will leave nameless, but he contacted Narsil a few years back and we found an excellent attorney in Decatur and we managed to get him unconvicted of a sexual offense because we got the right team together working on his case, but that was post-conviction and we threaded the needle through. We threaded the needle that I was tough to thread on what we had to work with in terms of our options post-conviction. But what helped save us was he went to trial and he had not jettisoned all of his rights. He had actually gone to trial and been convicted.
I don't know if you're familiar with the movie My Cousin Vinny, but these two kids, they're traveling out of state. They end up in Alabama. And I'm sure you know the movie, the TV show, The Munsters. So that's Fred Gwynn. He was the judge on the panel in the court trials. And the kids had selected they were using the court-appointed attorney. And he knew when they were behind closed doors and they were talking to him, and he was like, yeah, we're going to file this motion. We're going to do this. And as soon as he stood up in the courtroom, he turns on the biggest stutter. He's like, you run there, and they were like, oh my god, we're doomed. So even still, the person could have all of the right things to say behind closed doors but still be a poor performer in a courtroom too.
That is correct. And depending on your needs, if you're in a trial setting or if you're in a where hearings are going to be had, you want someone who can perform well in court. You know, we've got for Narsil, we've got a great lawyer that can do fantastic appellate work in Arkansas. I'm not saying he's a bad in court. He's a professor and he's in front of people all the time. But I've seen his work on paper and it's fantastic. I've not seen very much of his court work, so I'm not ready to tell people if you need a trial attorney to call him. I can tell you if you need an appellate attorney, they don't come any better than him. So that would be Professor J. Thomas Sullivan, who's written a couple of briefs for us. I would reserve judgment on his courtroom performances until I see him in court.
Could you, off the top of your head, could you list a handful of different areas of expertise? Is that the right way? So, talking about pretrial, post-trial, probation stuff, constitutional. I mean, I'm just rattling off things that might come to my mind. Can you expand on the different areas of expertise that an attorney might have?
Well, and most of our listeners are going to be post-conviction, so you're going to be really concerned about their knowledge of habeas corpus and post-conviction relief acts, variations of like in Arkansas Rule 37, like in Pennsylvania PCRA. You're going to be very concerned about how they do it in those type of settings. And a lot of the trial attorneys don't do post-conviction, and they'll take your money though. They will take your money and say, well, I'll give my best shot at it because they like to be paid, but they're really not. And you don't win a lot in post-conviction. So you have to craft your questions around your specific issue. And what I find I'm not answering your question because there's no easy answer, but
sure.
what I find is people don't know what the issues are. I'll ask people, I'll get a 17-page letter, which is an exaggeration. They're usually 6, 8, 10, 12, 15-page letters from people in prison. And they'll tell their whole life story. And none of that stuff is the points that they're trying to make on appeal. And I say, I'll write them back and say, would you please succinctly tell me what your appellate issues are? They can't do it. If you can't tell your lawyer what your appellate issue is, I can just about guarantee you that your lawyer will not be able to tell you an appellate strategy. The fact that you don't like being convicted is not an appellate issue.
Okay. Right. Right.
Your appellate issue is, or my appellate issues are, they tied me to a stockade and they beat me for 3 hours until I confessed and signed the document. That's an appellate issue. That's a coerced confession.
Right.
You don't need 14 pages to tell me that. If you've got video of the judge sleeping with the prosecutor, that's a conflict of interest. That's an appellate issue. So number one, they tied me to the stockade and beat me. Number two, the judge was sleeping with the prosecutor. If you can't do those issues, you will never find the attorney you need.
Because, and then also we would enter into the area of paying for that attorney too.
That is a big part of I get this all the time. Well, no attorney will take my case. And I said, well, when you say no attorney will take your case, do you mean no attorney would take your case pro bono? Or you told the attorney you were quite willing and able to pay a reasonable fee. And the attorney said, nope, I won't take your case because there's nothing here. It's usually that they don't have the money. Very seldom do they tell me, or they told me there's nothing here. Now, it would be great if the attorneys told them that there's very little here to work with, because pleas are often done with quite an extensive admonishment before the plea about what are you giving up. And they ask you, do you understand all these things? Do you read the English language? What grade did you go through in school? Are you under the influence of any narcotics today? Has your attorney discussed all this with you thoroughly? Do you understand you have the right to force the state to put you call witnesses against you, and it's the state's burden to prove you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? Do you understand that? Do you understand you have the right to call witnesses on your behalf to rebut the state's they go on and on and on with all these things, and you say yes, 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 yes. And at the end of that, they say, okay, and how do you plead? And you say guilty.
Yeah. It's not exactly fair to say, to throw all of those. I mean, there's completely new arena. If I laid down a computer manual, you would understand the words in your face, but you would not necessarily understand the concept and what the ramifications of said things are. So it's not a fair system in that regard either, because it's not a level playing field. You're not going in there with the level of understanding that someone such as you does right off the bat.
That is correct. But when they ask you, do you understand the English language? You need to say, no, I do not. What's the highest grade? If you don't, you don't. I mean, I'm not saying to say you don't if you do. But if you have trouble comprehending, you need to say, no, I actually have a learning disability. And then the judge can order an evaluation to find out if you're what we call competent. You have to be competent to understand what rights you're giving up. And if there's any doubt raised about your competency, then there's supposed to be an evaluation to determine whether you're competent. You're presumed competent until you raise evidence. You say, no, judge, I really don't understand that. I was in special education. I'm having trouble with what you're saying. Most judges, I can't say all, but most judges would say, counselors, approach the bench, please. Mr. Attorney, your client is saying he doesn't understand. We can't go on with this any further. Do you want to go talk to your client and find out if he does understand if this is a charade, or do I need to order a psychological evaluation? That's what should happen when a person says, I don't understand.
That's not even the, I mean, you could be 120, 130 IQ person. You could be a very well-versed, high-functioning person, but you're an architect, you're a doctor, you're not in the legal profession. So all of these terms, Jeff is saying, hey, Larry, can you talk down to me? Can you talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old and explain this stuff to me? Because it's completely new concepts and processes and so forth. It's just completely foreign to the vast, vast, vast majority of us. And then they're going to put it to you, and it's going to come at you at 100 miles an hour. It's really hard to try and pick up and gain a whole lifetime of education about the legal system, especially while you're being held in custody and all that, to try and catch up and understand the ramifications of the larger thing.
Well, theoretically, and I'm saying this is theoretically because I know this is not reality. In theory, you've read the plea agreement, you've initialed off on it. Most jurisdictions require you to sign it, but some jurisdictions require you to initial each component of the plea
agreement. Right.
Theoretically, you've told your attorney everything you didn't understand. Now, I know in reality, your attorney says if you don't take this plea, they're going to put you in trial and they're going to give you 195 years. And that's what you need to tell the judge. You need to say, Judge, I really didn't understand a lot of this, but my attorney told me I was going to get 190 years if I. Same thing's got, the judge is going to say, oh, counselor, approach the bench. We're not supposed to induce pleas by threats. What did you actually say? And the attorney's going to say, well, I told him if he got convicted of all the accounts and if the court were to run those sentences consecutively, that he would have an exposure up to 190 years. That's what I told him. And then the judge would go back and say, well, I'll explain that on the record. And he would say, Mr. Defendant, what your attorney told you was that if you were to be convicted at trial on all of these counts, being that you have 7 counts and each one carries 12 years maximum, if this court were to max you out and run those consecutively, you're facing 84 years in prison. That's not what you're going to get necessarily. That's your maximum exposure.
Sure.
Do you understand that? Do you understand if you were to be convicted and if this court were to sentence you as harshly as it possibly could, you could get up to 84 years? And then you would either say, yes, I understand that, or no, I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, are you telling me that there's a whole group of people who can't understand that?
That part you could understand. It's pretty daunting. And again, the playing field is certainly not level for us Luddites in the legal profession on what the ramifications of our actions are.
Well, it's not. It's just like when you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you you've got some kind of terminology I can't explain, and you've got this fibrosis and cirrhosis and gobbledygook and gobbledygook. You take your doctor's word most of the time. You say, unless you're like me, you say, well, doctor, actually, I think I disagree with you. But most people don't do that. I had a dentist tell me for 10 years I needed to have an implant and a post and all this, that, and other. He said, you're going to lose your front tooth. So number 9, he said, if you don't, I said, I don't think I am, doctor. I said, I think I'm going to leave it the way it is. And here we are. I think I had the accident in 92 when I fell on my face. I still got the same tooth that the dentist wanted to remove and put in an implant in 90. So, I mean, just because someone tells you something doesn't mean they're right. It's their opinion. It's their opinion. And the lawyer gives you an opinion that he or she believes that with the strength of the evidence that they have, that they're likely to get a conviction, more likely than not, if the jury gets to decide this case. That doesn't mean they're right.
Agreed. Let's move on, because this is definitely beating a dead horse. did we cover? We didn't cover this one yet. All right. This is from Vice News. And this is, the prison system is a nightmare, but not for the reasons you think. Long, pretty long article, not the longest we've ever covered, but it's pretty long. And I think they profiled a person that spent a decade or so in prison, maybe 2 decades. And some of the points in there that were really kind of interesting to me was talking about how it's turned into an industry and that it's pretty much just used for warehousing. But the article goes over that how much it's changed, but how much it's not changed over the centuries since we've had a prison system here in the United States. But like it says, in the South, after the defeat of Reconstruction, black prisoners were literally worked to death for private companies. That really began to end in the early 20th century because cheap labor became available and easily used all over the world. The prison labor became less and less important to industry and to corporations. They could get cheap labor outside of the prison system. And it seems, you know, the way the article is describing things is that we have used it to marginalize some group of people, you know, at different times for different things going through as the times have changed over the eons that we've had prisons. But now it's just pretty much just some sort of a warehouse system. There's a bunch of stuff in there that I think would be exactly mirroring the things that you've said about it, that we need to figure out a way to incarcerate less, find more ways to rehabilitate people or give them opportunities for when they get out and so forth. So I thought it was a pretty well-written article, and I liked it. And I'm glad you put it in there.
I put it in there because I couldn't help myself. There was a quote, and I wish I could figure out how to highlight it, but because I can't find it right now. But there was a quote in this article about we should make prison and the recommendations of what we can do be as much like on the outside as we can.
Yes, it's in the last paragraph.
Yeah, well, the last paragraph.
Yes, it is. It says, if we follow those recommendations to provide education and healthcare for everybody that needs it inside, to reduce the prison population by using non-carceral, non-prison techniques of resolving conflicts between people, to make life inside institutions as much as possible like life outside, so that there isn't this huge divide between the way people live inside and outside, and also in terms of reforming the police. If there were democratic controls of policing so that people decided what the police should do, what policies they should follow, what communities they should operate in, and what crimes they should try to go after. If we had something like that, it would be a profound reform and change in the way things operate.
Well, I liked both of those, and that's what I gravitated to when I read this long read in preparation for the recording, because I've said that, and they're copying me, and I don't appreciate not getting my royalties for that. But in terms of the police, I've said similar things, not on this podcast, but the police have this notion that they should decide what kind of equipment to use, what the law should be, how they should carry out their job. I disagree with that. The police are a reflection of us. We will decide what kind of equipment you use. We will decide what the penalties are. We will decide what the priorities are, and you will follow those directives. And people look at me, they roll their eyes and they tilt their chairs back and they almost fall over backwards when I say that. You know, like the local police here, the public schools, the APS police, they fought like hell to have guns in the schools. And I said, no. They said, we should get to decide how to keep. No, you don't get to decide that. You get to decide if you're an officer of the Albuquerque Public Schools police force. We decide whether or not you run around with guns on your side and if that's proper for an educational environment. And if you find it makes you, if it compromises your safety, by all means, go find something where you can be safer. So I really gravitated to those last two points because we decide those things, not you. You're the executor. We're the decider.
Didn't George Bush say that?
He did say he was the decider, yes. But I mean, do you disagree with me? Do you think the police should decide what equipment they use, how much time they spend on certain things, and whether or not they get to have battering rams to knock your house down with? Do you think they get to decide whether they get to tear gas everybody, whether they get to put handcuffs on pregnant women? Do you think that that's a police decision? Or do you think it's our decision as their employers?
I think I at least see that they would have say in it of influence of what would be appropriate, not necessarily that they just unilaterally make those decisions of they're going to use this new firearm, whatever, that it would have to still be approved. But since they would be the experts in the field, I mean, I don't have expertise in policing practices. I can decide that I shouldn't have a shock collar around my neck when I go to court. Well, but, you know,
but that's what the article says. If there were democratic controls of policing so that people decided what the police should do.
Right.
If we over decide what the police can do, we'll quickly find out we don't have any police officers. But right now we don't seem to have a shortage of police officers by the fact that there's not enough people volunteering. Now, what we do have a shortage of is that with the rigorous screening that we do to make sure that no one has smoked any dope in their life, and they'll shoot at every moving target that pops up because they do all this simulation and training, and they tell you that you're dead all these different times if you don't have a certain response. So they weed out a lot of people for various reasons that probably shouldn't be weeded out that might make very fine police officers. But
yeah, sure.
But it's a pretty good paying job. It's not like they're doing this as a community service.
Certainly that.
So, boy, now watch all the death threats I'm going to get now for saying that.
Anyway, I encourage everyone to go read it. I'm really excited about this next article. This is from Fortune Magazine, I guess. Is that fortune.com? Is that Fortune Magazine? I'm pretty sure it is. And the title of it is Fake Porn Videos Are Terrorizing Women. Do we need a law to stop them? I am terrified of this one that you're going to – I mean they profile that plenty of actresses are having their faces put into – so take like – we'll call them a stunt double. So take a real pornographic video and with – that social media is so prolific and everyone has 10,000 pictures of themselves posed up there in all kinds of different angles that you can now get computers to completely render a fake head. And now you can replace your, you know, fill in your favorite actress or actor here. And now you can put them in your favorite porn video, then go release that stuff online. And now you have completely doctored videos out there that are really difficult to distinguish from truth from reality. The other part of that that they don't cover in this article, but I've heard talks about it, is you could get enough of the phonemes of someone speaking, and then you could create, you know, and then use the same technique here. You could fabricate Trump saying whatever you want him to say, that he did pay off. I know. You could get Trump to like you need a whole lot of things. Never mind. You could get him saying whatever you want. You have the video to go along with it. You have and the audio, and it's basically flawless. I don't know how you get around, like, here's the video evidence of it. Do you deny that it's you? I deny it. But you would never get a jury to go, no, that's not him. Because there would be no way to detect that it's not him.
Well, I feel woefully inadequate to respond. I did read the article. It's a long read. But it's one of those things where technology has gotten ahead of our laws. I mean, who would have ever thunk about being able to do what you just described? I can barely think about it when you describe it. But making a porn video out of a star or celebrity, and then that defames them because you don't know the difference between it being false or not. But it said, according to the laws, it typically takes $50,000 to pursue a lawsuit, which is what you have the right to do under our existing law. If somebody's portrayed you as that's not you, then you can file a lawsuit. Well, there are people saying that that's way too cumbersome to actually file a lawsuit because there should be an easier takedown process. Well, we've learned from trying to get takedowns done that that's not a process that works very easily to get something taken down that should be taken down. So I don't know the answer. It sure has raised a lot of good questions, though, hasn't it?
Yes. And one of the things that happened recently, and this is FOSTA and SESTA, I think are the titles of the sex trafficking and whatever the hell they are. But that is how Craigslist ended up pulling down their personals. And now we covered it a couple weeks ago. Tumblr is going to remove their adult section or whatever it is. But the section of the law, it's called Section 230. And it keeps a internet provider from being culpable for what the people upload. And so that has been gutted a little bit, I guess, to then make it so that Craigslist may actually be culpable for having some sort of personals uploaded. They shouldn't be held responsible. Like the newspapers haven't been held responsible for somebody posting some, you know, an advertisement in the personal section. And I don't, how do you validate? So now you're going to go after somebody that is just providing a social networking site and somebody posts a video of a fake video. Why would you hold them accountable for what somebody else has done? I don't see how that works either.
Well, it's going to require a lot of evolution in our thinking of how far we're willing to go, because the Electronic Frontier Foundation, I would imagine, is going to be pushing back, saying this is Big Brother monitoring the internet.
And they were covered in there. But you know, then where does your First Amendment rights come in? You know, I mean, you could call it a free expression. You know, I just wanted to have some porn of my favorite hot actress here, and this is what I did. And someone stole my computer and uploaded it. How am I culpable for that?
Well, I was actually going to say that. Yeah, what? What makes it okay? You know, it's not you, and of course, I can say this with comfort because I can assure you, no one is ever going to make porn featuring me. So it's easy for me.
You old, dried, shriveled up thing, right?
It's easy for me to say.
Freaking crusty Larry over there.
But if you have the right to create art, and I'm not going to go so far as to say this is art, but certainly, I guess if it's out in the public domain and you want to take someone's head and put it somewhere else, who's to stop you from doing that?
Right.
That's right. The rhetorical question. I mean, who's to stop you from doing that?
I don't know. So yeah, so I saw that the EFF was pushing back, like there would be arguments on First Amendment, but maybe you could carve it out and go, this goes to like the Supreme Court side of it. Well, what defines porn. It's like, well, I don't know what defines it, but I would know it when I saw it. And that would be the same thing here. Well, how do you know it's some sort of pornographic material? Where does it cross the line between artistic expression and something along the lines of revenge porn or whatever? It's just like, I just, the computers are coming to take over, Larry, and I don't see how we're going to stop it other than actually changing like our moral code that this is unacceptable and we shame them in a cultural standpoint. They just don't do it from that point of view. I don't know. It confuses me.
Well, the part where Electronic Frontier Foundation comes in, the paragraph says, not everyone is convinced that this is a good idea. The Section 230 law is regarded as many as a visionary piece of legislation, which allowed U.S. internet companies to flourish in the absence of legal threats. The foundation immunity for websites could stifle business and free expression. This raises the question whether Congress could draft a law narrow enough to help victims of deepfakes, which is what they're referring to this as, and I've never heard this before, without such unintended consequences. As a cautionary tale, Anna Marie Britti, a law professor at University of Idaho, points to the misuse of copyright takedown system, which companies and individuals have acted in bad faith to remove legitimate criticism of other legal content. So this is a tough one.
Yeah, I don't know how that minefield gets navigated.
So it's a very tough one.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Hey, let's go talk about my favorite subject in the entire world. This is from ShelbyStar.com.
Yes, this is about your favorite.
This is my absolute favorite subject. Private investigator brings polygraph services to Shelby, Cleveland County, North Carolina. This is so exciting. And as I was reading through it, I was like, oh, this guy's actually trying to help out the defendant of being falsely accused. But I just some of the statements here. So the polygrapher guy is named David Poston. And it says he has a knack for spotting lies. First off, if he has a knack for spotting lies, why does he need the polygraph machine? That's my first criticism of it. And he says that polygraphy is an evolving science. And that's bullshit right out of the gate because it's not even science to begin with. So it can't evolve. And then I said, for that to be true, I mean, it would have to be a science and it's not, it's voodoo. Ah, this drives me crazy.
Well, if you say so.
So he says he studies it. He's supposed to have a minimum of 12 hours of training every 2 years, but this guy has racked up 30 years alone in the past year. It's like, okay, dude, you're studying a lot of voodoo. It just bothers me. There's no scientific evidence behind it. If he is capable of watching your little micro expressions to figure out if you're lying or not, well, then he is the skilled expert at this, which is also probably bullshit, but.
Well, the machine validates what his observations are, though, because he analyzes your body reactions, and then he analyzes what the computer picked up, all the different readings, and I can't explain all the different things it's measuring, but it's measuring a whole plethora of things: breathing and respiration and heart rate and what do they call that, galvanic skin response.
Yes. Yes, they're checking for the moisture on your skin to see if you're some level of sweating, which only means that you're stressed. They're checking for your breathing speed, which again only means that you're stressed. They're checking for your pulse rate, which again only means you're stressed. They're checking for your eye fluctuations, which again only means you're stressed. It doesn't mean that you're lying or being deceitful.
Well, I think we should have Mr. Poston come on.
God, should we do that? Should we actually try and invite the adversary on here to get them to defend their claim?
Well, if he'd be willing to come, I'd be willing to. This would be fun. I could just sit on the sidelines and let you have at it with him. So you can tell him it's voodoo.
Yeah, God, would I be appropriate in staying aggressive against somebody like that? Or would I be best suited to pull back and
I would be
pander along and let him? I don't know. I don't know how to interview the adversary.
I would be very, very nice and let him explain his science, his evolving science, as he referred to it.
Oh my God, it's fucking bullshit. All right.
You can't
All
say
right, from the
that.
New
You
York
can't
Law
say that on a
Journal.
family program.
I whispered it. I whispered it. I'll bleep it in post. No, I'm not going to do that. All right. U.S. judge halts imposition of registration requirement on parolee with no sex offense record. I think we've covered these kind of things before where someone gets acquitted or a very, very minor offense, and then he ends up on the registry and has all these onerous requirements. I think the question I wanted to ask of you about this kind of thing is if a person that doesn't have the actual sexual offense on them, but they end up getting all these restrictions put on them. And he says that it says that, how onerous it is for a person to survive with all these labels on them. It seems like that almost emboldens our case that, fine, you got convicted of it. You still have these onerous claims put on you to make your life so difficult to live by. It almost feels to me like these things actually support our cause.
Well, they do. If you have a purpose of a purpose, if I can pronounce it, judge, what we have here is a person who actually has a conviction that qualifies as a registrable offense. It's not a sex offense, but it's a kidnapping of a minor, and that is puts them on the offender registry in many states. That was
Right.
actually in the original Jacob Wetterling Act. That it was more geared toward people who had committed crimes against minors, and so if you go rob your local Subway and you lock the teenagers in the cooler so they can't identify you, that's generally considered something along the lines of a false imprisonment. That would qualify,
Right.
or taking one of them with you as a hostage, even though you have no sexual interest in them. And he was convicted of a registrable offense. It just wasn't a sex offense. So he
Right.
goes into federal court, and he finds him one of these lifetime liberal do-good, legislate from the bench type of judges. I'm doing this because this is what they claim when we win. Something that the generally conservatives disagree with. They pretend that you judge shop, which you don't get to judge shop. You file it, and it's a random assignment. But he went in and judge shopped and found him a liberal lifetime appointed judge that decided that she wanted to usurp the will of the legislature. The New York General Assembly decided that kidnapping is a registrable offense. And that is, if you believe in states' rights and you believe in judges being the interpreters of the law, I don't know how you could support his decision, because the judge did not interpret the law. The law clearly covers him, and the adverse consequences that flow from that is not for that judge to decide. The judge was to
Right.
decide whether or not the law covered him, and it clearly does, and it clearly does in
Right.
a lot of states. So you should have a beef if you're a textualist, and if you believe that judges exist not to legislate from the bench. This should be as offensive and appalling as anything you could ever hear of. Of
Right.
course, I happen
Right.
to like it because I believe that generates a discussion about it, and it forces the assembly people in Albany to think about if they're going to call something a sex offender registry. That maybe it ought to have something to do with sex. It's kind of like when you call it something a violent offense, and I have people say, "Well, wait a minute." I said, "Why do we call this a violent offense when there's no violence? I'm confused."
Right,
Well,
right,
so
right.
I appreciate that the judge did it, but it goes contradictory to what most conservatives would say that they want in a judge, because that judge is clearly deciding for the people of New York what they want, and that's not for that judge to decide.
Yeah. And I did find a little bit of a quote. It says, as such, he faced limitations on where he can live and travel and what he can do on the internet, even whether he can own a pet. How in the world does the sex offender registry prevent you from owning a pet?
Well, I've never heard of it, but I'd be anxious to hear. I've not heard of that, but I think as probation conditions that people might be prohibited from owning a pet, particularly if that's been their offense pattern.
Well, I mean, if you're convicted of some sort of sexual offense and bestiality is in there, then that seems appropriate that you wouldn't be allowed to have a pet, at least not one with. Never mind, I'm not going to get gross.
So
That's really bizarre that you wouldn't be able to own a pet. Maybe that's to protect probation from you having some rabid pit bull that whenever they come to the door, you know, gets unleashed and attacks the handlers coming to your door.
Probably. But now this is just a preliminary injunction. It is not the final outcome of the case. So the case could flip again when it's finally outcome. But to get a preliminary injunction, you've convinced the trier of fact that you're likely to succeed on the merits. So the judge has already telegraphed that it's not looking good for you, New York, to have this law that calls someone a sex offender. Now, you see, New York could come back and fix that. And I got to whisper this so that people in Albany won't hear this. All you have to do to fix this is to take the term sex offender off and call it an offender registry. And then once you do that, you can say, well, he's not on a sex offender registry. He's on an offender registry.
Right.
Now, but
has that been floated anywhere to change the, you know, that would broaden it to be you're just a convicted felon. You're an offender.
Well, there's some states that do call it that, where they register more than sex offenders and they call it our violent, or they call it our offender, violent crimes. But they can fix that by saying, well, judge, it's not just a sex offender registry. I mean, it's an offender registry and we happen to have that offense listed as, and it's our prerogative, not yours. If you want to decide what should be on our list of registrable offense, maybe you should climb off of that bench and run for assembly.
Right. Gosh. But okay, so that one might go in our favor, but then also the legislature will turn around and possibly undo the positive aspect of it.
Well, they could, or they could take that thing off, or they could require, see, we've fixed that a long time ago in our state, thanks to our work. We've got that fixed where the kidnapping can be registered, but it has to be proven that it was a sexually motivated kidnapping. And the burden is on the state to prove that before you can require registration. But our law used to be the same way. But we fixed that some time ago.
We went down to the state capitol and we told the legislators that we didn't want it that way. So we collectively made it so that it wasn't that way anymore.
We got a lot of help from the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we were able to convince them that a sex offender registry should require some sexual motivation to be on a sex offender registry. And there's other things I'd like to do with that. I want to take indecent exposure off the list. It's not required. I mean, it's required and it's on the list, but you can be AWA compliant and not register indecent exposure. But all 57 states have it on their list of registrable offenses, as far as I know, and it's not required. You can put it there, but when you submit your compliance packet, you don't have to have indecent exposure as a registrable offense. And you'll still, that won't be a factor in the consideration because it's not on the list of the AWA list of target offenses. It's not there. It's just something that sprung up through years of while they're out there showing their junk. They've got to be a sex offender.
Right. And then coming out of Milwaukee, we have the Journal Sentinel. Sex offenders would be able to reside in a whopping 24% of the city under Brookfield's new ordinance. So this is the city of Brookville. Has repealed and recreated its sex offender ordinance to ensure that the city is able to enforce its ordinance and prevent the city from a costly federal lawsuit if it is deemed unconstitutional. Prior to their reworking of it, people that had registrable offenses would be able to live, I think it says, which is currently 7.5% of the city. And they feel that that is going to come under constitutional challenge because there's not enough place for people to go. So they've reworked it where certain kinds of parks might be or not be included and playgrounds may or may not be, et cetera. So they've removed the loitering provision and there is an approval process if you can get yourself in front of a judge and get some sort of an exception put in place. So yes, from 7% to 24% is a huge improvement, but still 24% is pretty – that's a lot of places you can't be.
Well, that is true, and this is a response to a lawsuit that was successful in Hoffman versus Village of Pleasant Prairie, where a federal district judge ruled that those restrictions, which were very similar, were unconstitutional. So we got to give them some credit. They at least, rather than waiting for Janice to come sue them, or someone similarly situated in that state, they realized that if they don't make a change to increase the availability of housing stock, that they're vulnerable. So they're taking a proactive measure to to dramatically. I mean, if you go from 7% to 25%, that's three, almost four times as much. I mean, so it is a step.
Three and a half time increase.
Of course, I think 100% should be available. Don't you?
Right. Exactly.
So, but this is in response to a federal judge. They don't want the same thing to happen to them. But that doesn't stop it. That doesn't stop it from happening. You can still come back and say it's still too small. I mean, you can still sue them if you want to.
Sure, sure. Just, you know, 7% is an easier hurdle to climb in your suit than 24, I suppose. I guess that's how that would come down, right?
That is correct.
Hey, you know what we need in this world? We need more registries. So there is a push. This is in Boise, Idaho. It's called Tina's Law. Aims to create legislation for domestic violence offender registry. And this way, my point here is something where it says that you shouldn't be able to hide from this and move from one state to another. And it says, hold them accountable for their actions. They can't run from, say, Arizona to Washington to Florida to Hawaii or whatever, because they will be on a national registry. But come on, man. You, like, in the modern era, you could just, like, go click and search for the person's name and know that they are a convicted felon from another state. And feel free to do what you want to do with. I like, why do we need yet another registry to keep people accountable between different different states or cities like that?
Well, if you read the rest of that story, you'll see why. Because of the death of it's a sensationalized case of a domestic violence that turned really awful. And we have a propensity to want to fix things. You know, these rare instances, they trigger a significant overreaction, I think, in my opinion anyway. It's an overreaction that domestic violence is a horrible thing, and millions of people suffer domestic violence in this country, and a significant number are actually men, believe it or not.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, it's far more women, but a significant number of men are victims of domestic violence, and they suffer from all the prejudices of, yeah, she weighs 110 pounds and you weigh 190. And she's, she beat me over the head with a fright. Well, it wasn't really all that bad. I mean, how hard can she hit you? But we effectively have what you said. Your criminal history is with you, regardless of where you go. And domestic violence, and I do feel bad for people, but it's one of those things where it's so difficult to prosecute because there's a love factor there. And, right. And often there's a recantation or there's a deliberate undermining of the prosecution. I'm not sure any amount of this will fix domestic violence, because if you fall in love with someone and they've moved from Arizona to Maine and they were convicted of domestic violence in Arizona, they put on this beautiful act of how sweet and lovable they are, and they fall in love with someone, and they don't, the domestic violence doesn't usually, from my understanding, manifest itself early in the relationship. They don't start engaging in domestic violence when they're in the courting process. And it's only when they get in a serious relationship that the symptoms become more obvious, and it tends to escalate over time. And so I just don't see that that's going to be a solution. It all it's going to do is make more lepers of people. And of course, we'll be opposing such registries every chance we get. In my state, I can tell you that any registry that's proposed, we oppose. We don't care what it's for.
Right. Sure. Well, I mean, another point of that is, you know, what is the actual effectiveness of the registry? The sex offender registries, you could probably expect that a domestic violence one would have some sort of equal level of effectiveness.
Well, it's hard to measure the effectiveness of the registry. We I tell people the crimes that didn't happen are most difficult to count. But I don't try to defend it on that. I try to defend it on you just can't punish people after they've done their time. I don't go with all that statistical start to say BS, yeah. but people who believe it are happy to make the argument. I use my little Gatling gun analogy. Let me put 100 bullets in it, and I'll tell you, only three of them are live rounds, and you go out 100 yards length of the football field, will you let me shoot it at you? You know only three are going to kill you or hurt you.
Right.
And most people wouldn't let you do that. So you can't win that argument that recidivism is low, and that if you buy into going down that path of if it saves one, and that's what you do when you say statistically you can't prove it. You can't prove it because the rates of sexual offenses are similar, even in the states that have harsh registries with those that don't have harsh registries. And rates of offending in general have gone down across the category of crime the last 25 years, which has been largely the history of the sex offender registry since the mid-90s. So you can't deduce anything. So I don't want to argue that way. boys and girls, you just can't do it. If you're going to have onerous requirements or you're going to impose these on people after they've done their time, you just can't do it. You can perhaps have a mail in a form to you and register once and keep their address current through mail. You can possibly do that within the constitutional framework, but you can't further restrict people's liberties after they pay their debt to society. So that's my tag. And I'll let people that want to argue about the statistics do that.
And here we have two articles that are basically covering the same thing with a little bit of a different spin on them, but both of them are from the New York Times, and it's federal courts running out of money, brace for a shutdown pain. And the second one is shutdown threatens to delay criminal justice reform signed into law by Trump. Here we are. What are we coming up on, 30-ish days of the shutdown?
Yes.
I forgot the exact number. I know it's past 3 weeks, so we're probably coming up in the high 20s. And I didn't really think about this. You brought it up a handful of days ago when we were talking on the phone that, like, the court system is running on, you know, on fumes of the federal court system, on money that they just, you know, have in their petty cash box, I guess. And so people that are expecting due process are going to have it delayed. And so on the one side, it could be good. On one side, it might not be so good.
No, that would, I can't imagine that there, I can't conceive of who would benefit in our constituency from the courts closing down, because if you're pretrial in the federal system, and that's what we're talking about, it's the federal system, you're largely in some form of custody, oftentimes very harsh custody conditions, because they've had such an overuse of pretrial detention in the federal system. But if you're not in pretrial detention, you're in rigorous monitoring. You'll be at a halfway house with them monitoring you very rigorously. So you could run the risk of having to be in those preventative detention facilities for a very long period of time, depending on how long this goes. And if you're trying to get post-conviction relief from the federal system, in which a lot of state cases go in through habeas corpus proceedings in the federal court, if the federal courts are not able to operate, that would tend to inure to the benefit of the state. If you've got a good habeas claim and the courts are shut down, that just delays the claim being considered. So I don't see how we would benefit much from this. I guess the person might benefit would be somebody who was released on their own recognizance, if there is such an individual in the federal system, and they were scheduled for trial and their trial gets put off indefinitely. I guess they would, but I'm not aware of very many people in that condition, in that situation.
It's 29 days at the moment, by the way.
It is a record, I think.
Oh, it is. It's definitely the longest. The second longest was 21 days, and that was in 95. Under Clinton.
That was back in the, yeah.
So anyway, I didn't realize it was 29. I knew it was in the 20s. So that's some good news. I didn't realize that. To me, that, and I probably the question that I wanted to ask you, like, pre-show was about what constitutes someone being quote unquote essential versus.
I wish I knew that.
To me, it seems like the courts would be considered essential-ish.
Well, and that would be the thing that I would expect to eventually see start happening here, is that Congress will seek to reopen what they consider more essential functions of government, and they might be at the threat of an override of a presidential veto, because the president has steadfastly said that he won't allow anything to be reopened and that he's going to veto anything. So it's going to require a piecemeal approach if they can't come to an agreement on the border wall funding. And I would consider the courts to be essential, but it is an interesting debate, because most private businesses, they consider all their employees to be pretty much essential. And so when the government can shut down and send home a third of the workers and say they're non-essential, it kind of sends out a bad message to folks. They say, well, why do we even have them if they're not essential? Well, I think you're starting to see how essential they are. Traffic control is going to suffer. TSA screening is going to suffer. TSA screening is already suffering because there's a lot of call-in sick. People are not getting paid, and they're getting a little frustrated about why they should show up to work and not use their time to look for other jobs if they're not going to be paid. Most people expect their payday, and they rely on that. So it's becoming a very ugly situation, and it's going to harm lives, and I think it's going to eventually harm the economy with a million people not collecting a paycheck. So time will tell, but it's lasted longer than any other one.
Yep, a long shot. So it's an interesting little spin on how that might impact some of our people, either trying to get relief or, you know, they're stuck in detention and maybe they would be found innocent and go home, but here they are, they're stuck. So they get to spend their more time in pre-detention stuff, right?
Right. Well, if you listen to the largely conservative talk show host, you'll hear that the government's shut down. Nobody misses it. Well, that's not true. There are a lot of people who are missing government, and they've even taken steps to try to keep people from being denied their tax refunds. So they've recalled 30,000, I think, Department of Treasury employees to try to do tax returns. But if they're not going to pay them, if they don't have the money to pay them, the authority to pay them, I don't know how many of them are going to show up of the 30,000 they recalled.
Right. All right. So here is something where I wanted your opinion. This is an article from Slate, and this is going to have you pulling out your deep legal theory propeller hat kind of thing and trying to get in the mind of Neil Gorsuch and the other conservative justices, because the Supreme Court just handed a big unanimous victory to workers. Wait, what? Conservatives don't normally side with workers. They normally side with corporations. I guess that's sort of like the painting with a really broad brush here. And the case was an individual who was working as a driver, and he was listed as a contractor. Thus, he's getting paid by the hour, but the company is taking his expenses, like, you know, rental of the truck and miscellaneous other things. He would actually end up with a negative paycheck at the end of the 2-week period because he's not an employee. He's listed as a contractor. And I totally just threw this in here. I threw this in here actually like a couple weeks ago because I wanted to get your opinion on the frame of mind between the conservatives versus the liberal kind of justices and how that kind of clashes against what our issue would be, or in this case, in this this worker dispute. And so what do you think?
Well, I think it's an example of textualism coming to be beneficial, because that's how Gorsuch was able to justify, of course, it was a unanimous decision, I think, but that was how he was able to come to that decision. Is he said that this was a class action lawsuit for people, a class action lawsuit sometimes is the way to go. And so this guy launched a class action lawsuit on behalf of the truck drivers who had similar claims. And the company argued that there was an arbitration agreement that had been entered into, and that therefore it was binding, and that he didn't have the right to go to court, that he had to be subject to binding arbitration. But the amicus briefs that came in described when that particular act was passed in 1925, that employment was considered work. And that if you looked at dictionaries from the time, that they didn't distinguish, you know, a contractor, that was something that evolved over time. You know, and independent contracting is misused a lot by employers because they want to avoid things that employers are responsible for. So as society has imposed more requirements on employers, they try to find, I mean, I think you're familiar with the concept. And so the conservatives said, well, now we got to take a look at that darn thing, just like what that would have been interpreted in 1925, which is almost 100 years ago. And at that time, employment would there would have been no distinguishing. Therefore, he is an employee. He's not a contractor. There was no such word back then. So therefore, he is not bound by these arbitration agreements that are imposed on contractors, by golly. So that's how they got to that decision. I haven't read the decision, but that's best I can take out of it from the story, is that it is a big victory, though, because he's able to proceed with his case as a class action and have his day in court and try to prove out his claims as a class rather than as an individual. And that's just fantastic news if you believe that workers do have valid grievances, which I do. I don't believe all companies are pure and driven as the wind-driven snow, and that they do only good things for people. And I believe that this is a good thing.
Well, it's pretty notorious that a company, and not to say that UPS is a bad company, but they keep their employees at like 35-ish hours so that if something does run over a little bit, that they don't ever pay anybody overtime. And that also then keeps them from having to pay health insurance and other kinds of full-time employment benefits because none of their employees are full-time. I get the corporate strategy behind it of reducing expenses, but it's kind of a shit move.
But now let's be clear, we're not talking about UPS. We're talking about New Prime here.
Oh, I know that. I know that. No, I didn't mean that.
I want to make sure the listeners know that we're not bad-mouthing UPS. We're talking about this one company called New Prime.
But yeah, so I mean, companies even the company I work for, I mean, the bottom line is what matters pretty much first. After that, then they'll layer on other things. But when it comes down to it, they're going to save their own bacon first.
That is correct. It's an interesting that result. The dictionary definitions from 1925, and they say they looked at like six dictionaries, citing six dictionaries from that era, as well as contemporaneous statutes and ruling. Gorsuch concluded that a contract of employment was understood to encompass work agreements involving independent contractors.
Okay.
So as a result, Oliveira, along with his other truckers and transportation, qualify for the FAA exemption. So his class action will proceed to court.
That's interesting. Huh.
So textualism did us a favor.
Right. I totally see that as being just like, it could work in your favor. It could not work in your favor. But I also see that you shouldn't necessarily stand on one side of the fence. But then that introduces all of the interpretation that it shouldn't just be whether it supports your claim or not. There are places where it applies and where it shouldn't apply.
That's why I bring this stuff up. I want people to I have these bumper stickers I've handed out at conference before. Don't believe everything you think.
I have one.
And a lot of times you think you're in alignment with something, and if you really think it through, you'll figure out that you're not, that that's not what you really support. I'm a provoker of thought.
Don't provoke.
And people who religiously say that they're a textualist and that there should be all this evolving standards of decency is hogwash. And I remind them, well, okay, if that's what you are, then don't complain about the results, because that's a very logical outcome if you are a textualist.
Right. Right.
And the rest case I keep harping on, that was a completely logical outcome, because the text says he will register. And by golly, not only did he register, but about 70 other out-of-state convicted juveniles are now registering in Nebraska.
Yeah.
As far as I know, I don't believe that they've been able. I think that Judge Koff, if I remember right, and Hank, you can feel free to correct me, but I predict that he would dissolve his injunction, and I believe he did very shortly after I said he would, because he didn't have anything else to hang his hat on.
We haven't heard from Hank in a little while.
Oh, yeah. He sent us something just this past week. I just didn't respond to him. But thank you, Hank, for sending that.
He's still sending it to the wrong email address then.
I know. He's struggling. He's struggling with your email address. There's something left out. But I did get something from Hank. And there's a piece of legislation that can be a little more specific before we conclude, that they're going to expand the definition of violence to be very broad. So practically anything. What they're trying to do is to make sure that even if you don't use force, that they define force broadly enough. And I misspoke when I said violence, but they want to define force broadly enough to include things like, I remember a police officer from Gwinnett County, Georgia, your suburb of Atlanta there. He argued that he had a conviction where he rolled up on a couple having sex, and he told the boy to get going. It was a younger guy, and he told him to get going. And then he worked out a solution with the adult woman, and she said that was force, that he was carrying a gun, and that they were able to work it out, but that constituted force, and the Georgia courts agreed with her that a person carrying a gun saying we can get this all straightened out, that is force. Well, is it? It's coercion, but is it force?
Right. Yeah, I get that. Yeah, sure.
So that's what Hank sent me, that they're going to expand the definition.
Okay. All right.
So that they can get more people convicted. And it's going to be, Hank, it's going to be really hard to fight that. It's going to be really, really hard. I'm not saying doom and gloom, throwing the towel, but I'm telling you that, and all the listeners in Nebraska, that you've got a very well-organized establishment that's pushing for that. And it's the victims' advocates, the Me Too movement, and a whole lot of people on the law enforcement side are saying that they need that so that they can prosecute bad guys. And when they look around the room at the hearing and ask people who are opposed to it, there's not going to be a soul in there. You'll hear nothing but crickets.
Right.
And it's going to be very hard for those 49 senators in Nebraska, which is all they have in the one chamber that they have, the unicameral. It's going to be very hard for them to say, actually, you don't need this, when there's not a soul there speaking against it.
Gotcha. Well, let's shut this mother down.
All right.
How can people find the podcast?
Well, it's going to be very difficult if I don't have my screen open to that. But
you don't have this stuff memorized. This is episode 60, and you still don't have this memorized?
Well, I got the phone number memorized, but they have to go to registrymatters.co first.
Gotcha. Okay, good.
And I just referred that to an attorney who didn't know about us in my state, and she said, "Awesome, I'm gonna check that out."
Oh, please, if you are that attorney listening, please write in and let us know what you think. I would love to hear from you.
And then the way I like to communicate people is old fashioned. You can call us. It's 747-227-4477, and you can leave a message because we don't have any staff to answer the phone.
And what about sending us an email message directly?
All of these are going to go to Andy if you do that, but you can send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And then what is the ultimate bestest way to support the podcast and show your love?
That would be through patreon.com/registrymatters.
Outstanding.
And you can get yourself hooked up.
Absolutely.
To us.
And then receive some blue balls.
We can hook you up. I was going to say, we hook you up with blue balls.
Absolutely. Hey, if I haven't sent you blue balls and you are like waiting by the post, by the mailbox every day, like, let me know and I'll get one shipped out to you.
And that would be to let you know they would send you an email at the email I just gave, registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Or there's a form on the website that you can send, and that comes to my personal email. So yeah, either way. So that's all I got, man. I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Well, thank you, Andy.
And I will talk to you soon. Take care, Larry. Bye-bye.